Very good. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for September 16. This is the second of three scheduled oral arguments, although we have a cancellation or rescheduling, I should postponement of the first case. So I'll ask the marshal to reintroduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Warkey, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And once again, welcome. This matter right now scheduled is A210365, Katrina Lynn D'Antoni, the respondent, versus Donato Antonio D'Antoni, the appellant. And we have both counsel present. As you know, the process is all the same, except we're not all together. And so we're all kind of used to that by now. You should be able to see the clock in one of your windows. And so once appellant's counsel begins to speak, that will run in the usual manner. If for some reason we lose you from or us, if we have a disruption, the marshal knows to stop the clock so that we can resume. Otherwise, 15 minutes apiece and 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. And so everything else should remain the same. And counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself for a record and proceed.
Good morning, I'm Jill Brisbois, B-R-I-S-B-O-I-S. May it please the court, counsel. Today I have the pleasure of advocating on behalf of Mr. Donato D'Antoni. I don't intend to use my full amount of time, but I believe it's important to discuss what rights a petitioner or respondent have at an order for protection hearing. But I'm happy to answer any other questions about my memorandum, but I think those issues have been laid out for the court. 518B does not outline the specific rights either party is guaranteed at a hearing. However, this court has outlined the requirements of a hearing. First, either a petitioner or a respondent has the right to present witnesses. Second, either a petitioner or a respondent has the right to cross-examine witnesses. Third, either a petitioner or a respondent has the right to present evidence, including exhibits. Fourth, either petitioner or respondent have the right to have their case decided on the merits. On January 19th, 2021.
If I can interrupt, the bulk of your argument is on the third prong that you spoke to us about, and that was the fact that Judge Halsey in this case determined or denied evidence. So let's focus on that because that is the thrust of your argument. You know, I'm going to say this right away as a former trial court judge. Judge Halsey made a lot of credibility determinations. So when you were denied the opportunity to present evidence, your client did, in fact, have the opportunity to question and cross-examine his spouse, former spouse. I'm not sure where they're at in the proceedings. So how was he prejudiced? Because all of the information, it appears to me from the record, what he wanted to get in, which would have been an email or some such things, he was able to elicit that through direct testimony. How would he have been prejudiced? It goes to the weight of the testimony, wouldn't it?
It does go to the weight of the testimony, but again, central to the issue in this case, again, is credibility of the witnesses. And so the court is doing this balancing. And my client was able to testify, for example, Ms. D'Antoni sent him a text message or email saying what happened to this plant. So that issue became, you know, the credibility issue for the court. My client wanted to introduce that piece of evidence to impeach Ms. D'Antoni. And what Mr. D'Antoni's attorney was attempting to do at the hearing was to do that impeachment first. He asked Ms. D'Antoni about that text message. She denied sending that text message. And so he was laying that foundation to go in and impeach her and say, you sent this message, explain it.
And well, let me ask you this. If this court agreed with you on the I'll call it the plant issue because you indicate that there's some email communication, we don't need to have all of these instances. As far as I can count them, Judge Halsey has made a determination on three or maybe four instances, the knife incident, which was probably the most serious in terms of the findings of fact, and then the subway incidents because your client lived in a different community and according to the record, conceivably would not have been there. I mean, couldn't we have this petition be granted by the district court even if we threw out the plant incident?
Even if you threw out the plant incident, we can move on to the knife incident. In the knife incident, Ms. D'Antoni testified that on a specific date, my client held a knife to his throat and made some sort of threat of suicide. My client at the hearing was attempting to introduce that on the date, November 24th, 2020, sorry, my years are off. I apologize if I have that date wrong. November 24th, 2020, Ms. D'Antoni testified that happened. However, Mr. D'Antoni was attempting to put into evidence travel documents, his passport, and other evidence to show that he was not in the country at November 24th. So when the court says, okay, well, we have these other three instances. So we again have this credibility issue happening on the November 24th.
As the judge in this case, so when I review Judge Halsey's order, and maybe I'm wrong in terms of my recollection of that order, it's not in front of me, but I don't think he made a finding as to when this incident occurred. I didn't see a date in there. He may have heard the testimony, but we look at this from an abuse of discretion. And did Judge Halsey actually indicate that was the date of the activity complained of?
And I agree with the court. I don't believe that he made a specific finding as to a date. But the issue here is Ms. D'Antoni assigned a date to it. She's saying that this happened on this particular date. And that's
all. Let's focus on that. Why is the date important? Because your client did testify, correct me if I'm wrong, but my review of the transcript is that he testified as to the knife incident, that it did take place, but he, according to him, it was more of a lighthearted nature. So it doesn't appear that he's disputing that there was a knife incident. So why is the date critical? How is he prejudiced in terms of not being able to introduce the travel documents regarding the date of the incident? Isn't the incident itself the critical fact here?
Yeah. So my client testified that at one point he said, "You make me want to cut my head off." But there was never a knife involved in what he said, okay? And so the issue is my client never once testified that he held a knife to his throat. So again, we're having these credibility determinations where these two people are testifying about specific instances of events, but have very different versions of what happened. Ms. D'Antoni says there was a knife involved. My client says it happened months earlier, and he said, "You make me want to cut my head off," but there never was any type of knife involved. And so that's the distinction. And so when we're trying to do these credibility, determinations, we sometimes have to pick apart, what these people are saying. And that's what's important is my client was trying to say, this witness is not credible. And here's one reason why. She's saying this happened on a specific date. And my client's saying, I wasn't even in the country at that point. And so that's, again, why not being allowed to introduce this evidence at the hearing was important. As to Judge Warkey's remainder of the questions, we do have two other findings. Number one, we have the 911 incident, and then we also have the more general finding of fear of harm or imminent fear of harm. So we have those two. In my memorandum, I address both of those things.
Ms. Brisbois, can I ask you about the first of those two? I was going to ask you about the subway, and I'll just say this. When I read the judge's finding, it looks like part of 3A, and makes reference to he pulled up the car near her vehicle in which she was seated at Subway, causing her fear for safety and in order to intimidate her. And then on one of the occasions, he called 911 himself to attempt to interference with and responding to her 911 call. I'll be honest, maybe with both counsel, because you both construed that, I believe, to be a conclusion of the statutory criminal violation, which is incorporated in the OFP statute. And honestly, I did not read it that way. I read the first sentence as the basis for the OFP, the causing the fear, and maybe the court's understanding of the purpose, but yet I didn't see the court reference the statute or actually make a finding. But the fear alone would be sufficient, would it not, to support the court's OFP, even if we were to have a dispute perhaps as to whether there was actually the criminal violation as a separate violation.
Sure. And again, there may be the fear there, but it's the intent to cause fear. And so we don't have a record on what evidence by my client being, you know, presuming my client was in the subway parking lot, what evidence was there to believe that he had the intent to cause fear of imminent physical bodily harm? It's, you know, not, and that's the part that's here. He was simply in a parking lot. And that's the problem is, does his mere presence in a parking lot rise to the level of the intention? So number one, you need intention, but you also need that additional intent to cause fear of, you know, bodily harm. And those, it just doesn't rise to that level. Does that answer the court's question?
So many of these things are subjective in the eyes of the court, and it's difficult to have a black and white determination as to why he was there or why he wasn't there. That is the reason, as an appellate body, we review this for an abuse of discretion. I'm concerned about that because we didn't hear the testimony. We read the transcripts and we read argument of counsel. But what was the most compelling reason that your client put forth to Judge Halsey as to his reason for being at a subway when he didn't live in that area?
My client had been a resident of that city for 20 years. The record established that. A month earlier, he had been displaced from his residence of 20 years, and he was going to his post office box, which was in the same general, I think it's like a strip mall, as that subway. And so that's what the testimony was, is he was there at his post office box because the order of protection removed him from his home. So while he may have had a different location that he was at, the fact remains that this was his home of 20 years and he had a legitimate reason to be there, which again goes to the distance restriction.
And on the distance restriction, the way Judge Halsey penned his order, it sounds as if it's a distance restriction except for normal course of business, going to the PO box if it's still there, or for other reasons. So besides being restrictive in terms of time, I don't know that it has a lot of leg to it because there's clearly an inclusion in the order that says, except when you need to be there for personal reasons or to see friends. How do you differentiate between the restrictions in terms of 2 years, but then the caveat that, but you can be there if you need to be there?
I guess I didn't read that in the judge's order. I read it as he couldn't go within 4 miles of the marital home.
Except for business purposes or something. That was my recollection of what it said.
I don't believe so. And then I guess I would like to reserve my remaining 3 minutes at this point if the court would allow me to do that.
Counsel, I'd just like to turn back to the subway incident or incidents. From reading your brief, I believe that you agree that intent can be inferred. And so given the circumstances, there was an ex parte order for protection at the time, is that correct? And yes. He and husband, both husband and wife went to the same parking lot, correct? And husband arrived there after wife passed him, correct? During the first incident,
I believe that's
what's alleged.
I apologize. I keep on interrupting you. I keep on getting
ones. No, it's one of the drawbacks of Zoom. Zoom has a lot of benefits, and just us being here today is an important benefit, but there are some drawbacks. So I apologize too. But given those facts, why was it an abuse of discretion for the district court to infer fear in this instance?
And it may not have been an abuse of discretion to infer fear, but it was an abuse of discretion to infer bodily harm was going to result from that. That's the other prong that was missing, is it's the intent to cause fear of immediate bodily harm. And so while there may, again, I think the district court and, you know, Judge Slider kind of touched on this, the judge said it was intimidating and I think one other word, but there was just nothing about the idea that there was the intent to cause bodily harm. And so there's that other, you know, additional prong that's necessary. And I want to go back to something.
I'm sorry, going back to that, reading A and D together, isn't it possible to read the judge's order as indicating that given the history of emotional abuse, there was the judge inferred fear of bodily harm or physical harm, bodily injury or assault here, reading A and D together.
Sure. And, you know, and judge relied, I think it was on Barona for that. And again, in Barona, you know, we have kind of a different factual finding in there where it was the husband removed the gun from the home. And then on that next, the 3 days later, the husband was in the wife's face. The husband saw fear in her eyes. And so there was a lot stronger factual findings in that case versus here. We have people, you know, in the same parking lot where no physical contact was made. And so there's that distinction there where I agree what the case law is, but we still have this issue of being in the same parking lot does not, you know, rise to the level of fear of immediate bodily harm. Thank you.
And thank you. And you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal and counsel for respondent. Mia, you may identify yourself and proceed. You'll need.
I'm muted. Sorry. may it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Tiffany Wolter, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Katrina D'Antoni. Appellant is here today arguing that there are evidentiary rulings made by the district court, which have prevented him from being able to have a full opportunity to have a hearing on this matter. However, according to Koenig versus State Farm, the appellant must demonstrate that the prejudicial error to be entitled to a new trial or hearing is based, or excuse me, must demonstrate actual prejudicial error on the basis, on, excuse me, from the trial court in those rulings in order to have a full reversal here or to get a new trial. So the problem that we have here is that while the court, I don't believe the court made an error in the first place, but I don't think that if there were error made, that these errors are so prejudicial that we need to go back and we have need to have a new hearing on this. The issue of the here is that, frankly, appellant's attorney in this case was simply unprepared. We had a hearing that took place via Zoom, like we're having here today. Zoom hearings had been happening for months and months by the time that January 2021 rolled around. Questions should have been asked. How are we going to submit this evidence? How do we do this? Appellant's own attorney acknowledged that he had tried to file documents a couple of days prior, but because it was a holiday, it didn't go through, which doesn't really seem like something that would happen. And was trying to upload documents to a system that requires there to be, that isn't an instantaneous upload. You can't upload documents on the MNSIS system, have them, you know, just available for the trial court to take a look at. This takes some planning, right? There should have been some calls made. The attorney should have done some things to figure out how are we going to get this evidence to the court. You know, we're not in person. We're not at an OFB trial where we can simply just show up with a load of documents, put them in front of a witness and say, here we go. take a look at this, right? There's got to be some planning ahead. And there was clearly a failure of the attorney to plan ahead here.
Ms. Wolter, just to clarify, though, that are you aware of any rule that would have been violated by not doing so, given it the OFB type of scenario? And that, the reason I'm asking is it seems like it's while we all doing Zoom, obviously, especially at the trial court, it's a distant second best because of precisely these examples. And an OFP hearing is a perfect example. Almost always, I recall people bringing a bunch of stuff and we'd have to decide what's relevant and not. But that seems like that didn't occur. It was just, no, you don't have it. We aren't going to do it. But here where you've got a specific incident alleged on a specific day, and you've got evidence I was somewhere else, it almost seems the dots are all connected, that on its face, that's pretty important information for a judge to have.
I would agree, Your Honor, in this case, that there was no rule in effect that said he should have submitted those documents beforehand. It's just a matter of practicality and how we're going forward with these hearings, you know, today.
Ms. Walter, just following up, was there any order issued by the district court that required pre-filing?
No, there was not.
Was there any discussion of that? I know the matter was continued a couple times, or at least once.
I don't have any evidence of that. Neither Ms. Brisbois nor I were the attorneys that represented the parties in that case. So I don't have any documentation that there was any sort of discussion about that.
So there's nothing in the record that would require pre-filing?
No, correct. So we have two pieces of evidence that appellant seeks to have, sought to have admitted into evidence, right? One of those was the text message, and appellant was allowed to testify in detail regarding what that text message said. The text message was read verbatim, essentially into the record. The court knew what that text message said. In reviewing that text message, there are rules that we need to follow, however, to admit evidence into the record. If you take a look at that text message, which is found in my addendum that I produced, you can't tell who that text message is from. There is absolutely no way that that text message could have been authenticated and introduced into evidence, even if it was a part of the record. And my client testified she didn't send the text message. Appellant would have had the burden to identify that, provide proof that it is what it says it was and that my client had sent it to him. But there's no phone number, there's no name, there's no nothing to it. There's no possible way to authenticate that evidence. Regarding the incident with the knife, again, the problem here is that both parties testified about that incident. I disagree that my client testified that this incident took place on a certain date. A review of the transcript says that she was asked by her attorney what happened on November 24th, 2020. And then she began to testify about the incident regarding the knife being held to his neck. Later on, though, however, she was asked again, what was the date of that? And she said, you know what? I don't really remember what the date was. All I remember is that it happened on the day that I fled the home and I went to the Anna Marie's shelter. So her attorney had suggested that it happened on a certain date, but later on in her testimony, she disagreed as to what that date was. She couldn't quite remember. There was no testimony whatsoever in the transcript. Ms. Brisbois says, he testified it happened months prior. That's not true. That the transcript has nothing in it saying when Mr. D'Antoni tried to say that event took place. My understanding from the reading of the testimony is both parties talked about the incident where a threat was made by appellant that he was going to take his life. They testified very differently as to what happened, but they both testified that there was an incident that happened in the kitchen regarding a threat to end his life. So again, while these two pieces of evidence, you can decide whether or not they should have been admitted or not admitted, but again, was this error prejudicial? I don't believe that this error was prejudicial because all of this information was known to the court. Again, Mr. D'Antoni testified in great detail that he had, a passport that showed that he was gone for these days, that he had flight information that he was gone for these days, but the court did not find that to be credible. The court found credibility in Ms. D'Antoni. And as this court well knows, there's ample case law, Chosa, Gada, that you don't make the credibility decisions here. Judge Halsey makes the credibility decisions in this case.
Ms. Walter, can I ask the difficulty with reviewing, a findings of fact in an order for protection is they're fairly minimal, as they are here. But generally, we rely on those findings to determine whether they're clearly erroneous by comparing it to the record, but it's difficult for us to review abuse of discretion if the court doesn't use such phrases as it's inferring intent by X, Y, and Z, or in a maybe a more lengthy court trial. And I wanted to give you an example that Ms. Brisbois raised a good point, and that was you have the list of findings that were not proven. Two of those I noticed reference a car parked somewhere. And then we have the subway, and it's proven because a car is parked somewhere. And then we have the phrase intent to fear. How do we review how the judge was able to distinguish there was no fear in being in a cul-de-sac? I can't remember where the other location was. And yet being at a subway, that there is, if you follow my question, because I assume, and the second part of my question is, it seemed like the court relied heavily on violations of an ex parte order, which I assume you would agree that in and of itself is not a domestic abuse. It may be a criminal charge, I suppose, but there seems to be a lot of that seemed to be important to the court, that it was after an ex parte order as opposed to what was the intent of the purported violation.
Sure. So I think that the difference is in the two instances where Ms. D'Antoni testified, there was somebody sitting out of her house, outside her house, that she was in fear of, and she alleged that it was Mr. D'Antoni. Mr. D'Antoni testified it wasn't him. And he stated that he had some records from like parking ramps and things like that, showing that he wasn't even around during those days. So there was some discussion, there was a, you know, back and forth between those incidents. And apparently in that situation, Judge Halsey actually found Mr. D'Antoni to be the more credible witness regarding those two incidents, right? Versus the subway incidents. If you review the transcript, Mr. D'Antoni never testified about the subway incidents. He never testified about why he was there or anything like that. What Ms. Brisbois just talked about him having a mailbox there, I don't believe that's anything in the record. I don't believe that's even in the record, other than maybe Mr. Grand testifying about it, or Mr. Grand's summation at the end talking about the distance restriction, perhaps. But Mr. D'Antoni testified nothing about why he was there, what he was doing, why he didn't leave, you know, when he saw her there, anything like that. And I think it's reasonable to infer from the fact that, yes, there's an order for protection in effect that says, you know, you can't have any contact, right? In both situations, Ms. D'Antoni was in the parking lot, parked first. Mr. D'Antoni then comes in, knowing that she's there, calls the cops, and you know, I think the situation is just a little bit different than those other two, right? And I think you can infer intent from there. I would note, you know, according to the Bonnet case, you don't have to manifest intent, right, to create this reasonable fear of harm, right? Certainly there's actions that people do that they don't intend to certain consequences. And that's not what the statute says. The statute says, you know, infliction of reasonable fear, bodily harm, physical injury, et cetera. It doesn't say intends to cause that. That's not part of the statute, right? And then we have the situation like in Bonnick, where he ripped up a marriage license and assaulted an insurance salesman. And the court said, you know, in that case, perhaps he didn't intend, you know, to make Ms. Bonnick afraid, but those are clearly actions where it was reasonable that she was afraid, right? So again, there's not this intent in the statute. I'd also like to talk about the restriction on the 4 miles. I do believe that restriction is reasonable under the circumstances. And I think that's what the case law gets at.
Help me with the record. I was trying to pull, you know, you get the electronics and we're on Zoom. I was trying to pull up Judge Halsey's order, but did it have like a except for on the four mile radius?
I believe that Ms. Brisbois is right regarding that. I don't read that in the...
Okay, all right.
In there. It just says respondent may stay a reasonable distance away from the residence of the protected person, specifically 4 miles. I don't see anything other additionally.
I mean, of course, I'll check after the hearing, but thank you.
Yeah, correct. So the issue here is that we had a situation where there were two instances, right, following the issuance of the order for of the ex parte order for protection, where respondent showed up at the same place in the city of St. Michael, Mr. D'Antoni showed up at the same spot where Miss D'Antoni was. He didn't leave. She was afraid. And Miss D'Antoni testified she wanted to be safe in her community, safe in her home. Mr. D'Antoni testified that he lives in downtown Minneapolis. He works in downtown Minneapolis. His daughter, they don't have any joint children together, and his daughter goes to school at Elk River. The only reason that he could come up with, or his attorney could come up with, is that maybe he would want to go to St. Michael and maybe he would want to be, you know, hang out with some friends. And in this situation, the case law, I think, is pretty clear that the judge has the ability to create a zone of safety around the petitioner, and but also can't, you know, violate the liberty of the person who is a respondent in order to do that. So, you know, the Courtney case talked about the 1 mile radius where the guy wouldn't have been able to be in the city of Minneapolis essentially for 50 years and found that was not reasonable. But in cases where people live further apart and didn't really have a reason to be there daily.
Going to that point, I think the record reflects that respondent lived in the community for approximately 20 years. Is that correct?
He did, but he had moved. He had moved, you know, I mean,
he had moved recently because of this situation. Is that correct?
There is nothing in the record about that, but that is not true. He had moved well beforehand.
Okay. given the length of time that he lived in St. Michael and that he moved relatively recently, did the district court adequately consider his personal liberty interests in terms of maintaining relationships with his friends in the community?
Well, I think the district court did, because in this situation, you don't have to go to St. Michael in order to visit your friends there, right? Friends could be visited in other places other than the 4 miles of around the residence. Other than that, Mr. D'Antoni would have no reason to be in St. Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. While I was on break, I did go back and check the order for protection that was issued after the hearing. There is no exception to the 4 mile radius around the marital home. And so the issue here is the person is allowed to be safe in their home. There also can be a distance restriction around, you know, the person's physical being too. But what the judge did was he said you can't come in within 4 miles of the marital home, and that's just an unreasonable distance restriction.
Ms. Brisbois, how much discussion actually occurred during the hearing regarding that issue? I assume generally it was usually an afterthought, because most of the time it's whether there's domestic abuse. And so how much information did the judge actually obtain from the parties related to that?
Very little. And he obtained the information from Mr. D'Antoni's attorney, and he didn't take testimony from Mr. D'Antoni on the issue. And so he specifically questioned Mr. Grand about the issue, but never took testimony on reasons why Mr. D'Antoni may need to be in the city of St. Michael and why that 4 mile distance restriction could be a problem. But again, any information on that came from Mr. Grand. Let's see. Just in following-
Ms. Brisbois, was it the district court's responsibility to ask those questions in your view? Or should his counsel have inquired of his client when his client was testifying?
Well, I guess it's hard to say. I mean, I guess it should have been his responsibility, but the 4 mile radius is an extreme radius, comparatively speaking. Again, I'm talking about personal experience. There's not a great record here to say, but generally in order for protections, we're looking at a 2 block radius, a 1 mile radius. And so I think even Mr. Grand during the hearing had suggested a 2-block radius. And so I guess, you know, attorneys probably should start making better records if we're going to be allowing these extreme distances around the marital home. So in answer to your question, I guess it was Mr. Grand's responsibility. The question is, what is a reasonable distance? And is 4 miles reasonable in this particular case? And I don't know that there's a great record on that issue.
Is it in your view, though, even though the record isn't adequate, the district court didn't, well, taking the record as it is, it's still your view that the district court didn't adequately consider his personal liberty interests in establishing the 4-mile radius. So could you expand upon that based upon the record we have?
The record we have is the district court says I'm prohibiting you 4 miles from the marital home, but doesn't justify why that 4 miles is appropriate. There are absolutely no findings of fact as to why 4 miles from the marital home is appropriate. And so there, it's the complete lack of a record on that issue. Had the district court said, I believe 4 miles is appropriate because X, Y, and Z, I'd be in a lot different position right now and probably wouldn't be making this argument because the district court would have made specific findings.
Can we turn back to the knife incident or alleged incident for a minute? I think you asserted that there was testimony from respondent that the incident occurred months earlier. Can you cite us to where in the record we would find that, where in the transcript? Because I believe counsel for respondent, I'm sorry, I'm getting my parties mixed up here, but in any event, can you cite us to where in the record that we would find that testimony about the incident occurring months earlier that Mr. D'Antoni testified to?
We do. Again, one of the things that I was doing on the break was going to look for that site when Ms. Wolter brought that up. I was incorrect when I said that. The testimony regarding the knife incident from Mr. D'Antoni is at page 50 of the transcript, and there is not a temporal time period on that piece. And I apologize for that misstatement.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
And one point I wanted to go back to was Ms. Wolters, during her argument, brought up the issue of whether or not the text message had proper authentication. The text message had authentication. Mr. D'Antoni said that this is a text message that I received from Ms. D'Antoni. The question is, what weight does the court give it? So she suggests that because there were no names associated with it, therefore it wasn't going to come into evidence. It would come into evidence. The question still remains, what weight would that court give it? And again, that's just an issue we never got to because the court simply didn't allow it in. I apologize, I just realized I'm out of time.
That's fine. I think both parties had a brief amount of overtime, and that's equitable, and you finished your thought. I thank both counsel. We thank you for your comments today, answers to our questions, and your briefing. We will be taking the matter now under advisement and issue an order within the statutory time period. You each have a good day. Thank you.